Step one, I'll begin with an overview of fifth force constraints today. Then I'll get into the phenomenology of specifically self-interacting scalar fields and the fifth forces that they give rise to. Then I'll talk about ETWASH, which is an experiment that measures gravity at very small scales, talking about submillimeter scales. I will discuss the computation that Justin and I have been doing to compute the results that I'd expect from ETWASH, given the scalar field, given the self-interaction scalar field. And finally, I'll address the question, will ETWASH be able to see this chameleon field? So to begin, in the low-energy non-relativistic limit, I take a massive scalar field, put in a Yukawa coupling, the interaction Lagrangian looks something like this. Now I want my Yukawa coupling to be a gravitational strain, Yukawa coupling. So I want the coupling constant to be proportional to the mass m of the fermion, and then since m phi psi bar psi dimension 5 operator, I expect it to come in suppressed by power of 1 over m Planck. And so the potential I get from this power correction looks like the ordinary gravitational potential plus a correction of order gravitational strain, Yukawa potential correction. Where this parameter alpha here is called the coupling strength, and in fundamental theories, it tends to be of order 1. The way I've written my interaction Lagrangian here, alpha would equal 2 times beta squared. If there are two different betas for two different particles, it's 2 times beta 1 times beta 2. And m here is the mass of the scalar field, phi. So that we can see that the mass sets up an interaction length, where 1 over the mass is the characteristic length of the interaction. And if the field were massless, it would be a long-range interaction. It would just be a correction of 2g. Now here's an overview of fifth force constraints. I'm sure you've seen this plot before. This is from the paper by Adelberger and Heckel and Nelson, 2003. The idea is that over a broad range of length scales, this Yukawa type fifth force is constrained with alpha or unity. We can go from length scales and orders, from submillimeter scales, a millimeter, a tenth of a millimeter, all the way up to astrophysical scales, 10,000 AU. Planetary lunar laser ranging, geophysical tests, and small scale laboratory tests. So I'll talk about the phenomenology of the scalar field when I put in a self interaction. I start out with a Lagrangian, and I just added the usual phi to the fourth self interaction. And here, this rho is just summed over all the fermions the field couples to. I get the following equation of motion, which is just the second derivative is equal to the derivative of an effective potential. And the effective potential I've written down here is just the mass term plus the phi to the fourth coupling plus the coupling to matter.
Sorry, why is the coupling up to the fourth?
Why is the coupling?
Yeah.
You mean the matter coupling?
Why is it psi bar psi and not something else?
So I want it to couple to the density of the matter, the number density. So it's one of these effects that I'll talk about that is it kind of hides when I put it in matter. So I need it to couple to the matter.
Sorry, all the same thing. So you couple to radiation as well, or
no? No, it doesn't. So I imagine that if I wanted a relativistic generalization of this, instead of the rho, I would have the trace of this just in the tensor, and so it just wouldn't see the photons.
So that's what you're doing there,
basically,
what you write in terms of
rho. Yeah, this is just low energy. Low energy, non-relativistic. So I'll discuss three different effects that the self-interacting field has that non-self-interacting fields would have. The first one is the chameleon mechanism by which the field behaves differently based on the background that you put it in, background density. The second one will be called the thin shell effect, which is that the field only couples to thin shells of matter. It'll only see a thin shell of an object that you showed. And the third bit of this physics is that the force that you would get from this field would necessarily be attracted. So I'll begin with the chameleon mechanism. In bulk matter, this matter coupling term would cause the field to have a positive mass. It's the minimum the field would move to some positive value rather than zero. And the field acquires an effective mass. And you'll notice that even though the mass of the, even if I set the mass of the field to be zero, which would ordinarily be a long-range interaction in the absence of a self-interaction, I will get an effective mass that's non-zero that depends on lambda as well as the field that minimizes the effective potential in the medium density growth. And this effective mass, when I just take the effective potential I showed you earlier and minimize it, scales as this. It's a factor of order unity at the Planck scale times beta the 1/3 lambda the 1/6 rho to the negative 1/3. And in more conventional units, if we're taking typical densities found in the laboratory, say the density of water, this land scale is approximately a tenth of a millimeter. And this comes out naturally. I haven't tuned anything. I just put lambda equals beta equals 1. And so we call this the chameleon because this field is able to hide in matter effectively. If I set m phi equals 0, it would normally be a long-range interaction. But when I put it into matter, it picks up an effective mass and lowers its scale so that you don't see it. It's harder to see. And to look at what this would do, we can look at the solution near an infinite plane of mass. It has some finite thickness. Let's say I set the origin of the coordinates on the face of the plane. And this is an interesting case to look at, because if you looked at the gravitational force due to an infinite plane of mass, it doesn't vary at all with distance. So that we will see that the field due to this chameleon scalar will fall off with distance. And we can see that it falls more rapidly with gravity. Now, I assume that the plane has mass and outside the plane is just a vacuum. So the equations of motion simplify considerably. And the solution with the right boundary conditions goes like constant times 1 minus x, the 1 over x minus b, where this b is adjusted to fit the boundary condition. It depends on the position of the plane. But the point is that as x is made large, as you go farther and farther away from the plane, the solution falls off as 1 over x, whereas the gravitational potential would increase linearly. Now, the force that a test particle would feel if I put it somewhere outside the plane in vacuum is the integral of this coupling term, which for a very small test particle, the gradient won't vary over the position of the test particle. So I get just beta times the mass of the test particle over something that goes like 1 over x squared. So we see that whereas a gravitational force from this plane would not fall off regardless of where I put the test particle, moving the test particle away causes the force to fall off as 1 over x squared.
D
is not exactly the position of the plane because it depends on the thickness of the plane. So the field inside the plane is not flat. It'll fall off towards the edge of the plane. And so I have to adjust B to match whatever the field is at the edge of the plane. But the point is that when I've done that, as I go farther away, far compared to the thickness of the plane, the force still falls off rapidly. So the chameleon effect was that the field, even a massive field, picks up a small scale in the presence of matter, and the force due to it falls off. Now, the thin shell effect has to do with the fact that when I put in a self-interaction, the potential has a minimum, which means that inside matter, rather than having a potential scalar field that increases steadily without bound inside the matter, for example, like the gravitational field, gravitational potential inside an infinite sphere, the potential in a massive object maxes out at some maximum value, phi sub rho, which minimizes the potential. And I'll show you the diagram right here. So the field doesn't go higher than a certain amount. I've plotted this for several different planes. And you'll remember the characteristic land scale for this field is about a tenth of a millimeter. So if we look at the largest plane, the 3-millimeter plane, the field far away from the plane. Oh, by the way, I've arranged these planes so that the rightmost edge of the plane lies on this black line, which is at x equals zero. And the planes expand whatever the length is into the x direction. So if you look at the largest plane, the 3-millimeter plane, you start out here in the vacuum, the field rises about a millimeter inside the plane. It hits its peak value and then just remains at that value inside the plane. And what you'll note when you look at smaller and smaller planes is that the field rises attains the same value, or rather, I'm comparing the blue to the purple here. And so the field attains the same value, and the field outside the plane basically doesn't depend on how thick the plane is at that point. I could take 1 millimeter plane, 3 millimeter plane, I got the same results when I did a 10 millimeter plane. The field just pops out to a maximum value, and out here looks exactly the same. Whereas for smaller planes, smaller than, for example, this characteristic distance of about a tenth of a millimeter, the field, the plane is not large enough for the field to attain its maximum value inside the plane. And so at that point, the field that you see outside the plane actually depends on the thickness of the plane. So the problem with this is that as you make the plane thicker and thicker, the field solution outside doesn't change, which means the force that it exerts on the test particle outside doesn't change. My force is proportional to the gradient of the field, and I've calculated this for a range of different plane thicknesses. The gradient starts out low and maxes out at a certain value, which means that the fifth force that you'd see on a test particle outside the plane would also max out at this value. Meanwhile, the gravitational force of the plane scales as the thickness of the plane, because you just have more mass per unit area. So if you're trying to detect a fifth force with a plane that's much thicker than this length scale, then the gravitational force will swamp the fifth force. You can see it falling off from this value of 2, which is what I'd expect for beta equals 1, down to like 2 orders of magnitude. The third piece of physics I'd like to discuss is the attractive force thing. The idea is that for a large range of mass distributions, the force that you'd expect, the fifth force, will necessarily be attractive.
If you have a vector field, it
would
be repulsive.
Oh, yes. So I'm looking at a scalar field here. But it could be repulsive for a vector field.
So this is an assumption?
This is true for scalar fields.
You've assumed that the fifth force is a scalar field.
That's right.
And it could be a vector field.
That's true. Yeah.
It makes a lot of difference.
Yes. So I'm looking particularly for this type of force. And so this is the phenomenology of this point of view. But certainly, yeah, there's no general rule against repulsive forces. We've fat graviton models and a couple other things also give you repulsive forces.
Sorry.
The fat graviton models where the graviton has a certain length scale, they also have a force that falls off as you get down to that scale. And again, certainly vector fields, yeah. So I'm looking here only at the phenomenology of this particular type of self-attractive scale.
So the only way to get around that is probably switch the sign of the kinetic curve to make it the Gauss system.
That may do it, yeah.
So I can get very, very repulsive.
Right.
That causes a cost.
All right, so let me go on. In order to show this, I'll start with the Hamiltonian. If I have a static mass configuration, the field that solves the equations of motion I showed earlier is the field that I'll minimize the Hamiltonian. So I just draw some arbitrary blob of matter. And now I assume that the matter is symmetric under reflection about the x-axis, about the yz plane. So the way I've drawn, this is the x-axis, this is the y-axis, and the yz plane comes out. And this blob of matter is sitting in some medium of uniform density. Now, I can solve the equations of motion for this, and I get some field, phi 1. I don't know what that is. That'll depend on the details, the geometry of this blob of matter. And now let me take this symmetric mass configuration and just slice out this middle section here and glue the remaining pieces together. The effect of that, since they're sitting in an infinite medium uniform density, is just the same as if I'd moved the two pieces together. And I could come up with a new solution, I shouldn't call this a solution, a new field, which probably won't solve the equations of motion or minimize the Hamiltonian, but let me define phi 2 this way. That is, I take phi 1 out here, I take phi 1 in the regions that I didn't cut out, I just glue the solutions for phi 1 together. And I define it on both sides by being invariant under x goes to minus x. So I'll show you an example of this for two planes. The field, the red field is the original configuration, where my two blobs here are replaced just by two infinite planes. And this blue curve here is the new configuration, the stitched together configuration, where I cut out the middle section and glue the ends together. Now I can plot the effective potential, potential energy density as a function of position also. And my claim is that, well, the potential energy density out here at infinity is either zero in a vacuum or something less than zero in a medium of some larger density, whereas the effective potential here in the region between the two is larger. So that when I cut out this section, I'm cutting out a piece of larger energy, and therefore the energy will go down. I will show a close-up of that region. Sorry, close-up of this region right in here. And you can see that the stitched-together solution lacks this region, this yellow region right here, which is all at positive energy. So I'm cutting out a region of positive energy. And that, the net effect is that, so by the way, this solution y2 is just something I made up, but since whatever the actual solution to the equation of motion is will minimize the Hamiltonian in the new configuration will necessarily be lower than the Hamiltonian in the Hamiltonian associated with this phi 2, which is already lower than the Hamiltonian in the original case. So I've shown that the energy goes down when you move these two blobs together, which means that the force between them must necessarily be attractive. Now, in order to do this, I had to assume that the potential is unbounded from is bounded from below, and that the mass configuration is symmetric. So this applies to these chameleons, but it's not obvious how to generalize this to asymmetric mass configurations. The thing is, it's also hard to imagine how, given my arguments, I could take an asymmetric mass configuration and somehow get a repulsive force. So as a fairly general rule, the force I expect from this will be attractive.
So, don't you also have to take into account the kinetic part? And wouldn't that pick up something from the solution, the new function being non-differentiable when you cut out the piece?
So since the kinetic term just contains first derivatives, and the derivative is piecewise continuous, it just has a finite jump discontinuity there. So that just kind of... So the derivative is something negative, it jumps up to something positive, but then if you're just integrating that over space, you'll get a little bit under the curve here, a little bit under the curve here. But you don't get anything blowing up from that discontinuity. If you had some sort of second derivative trip, that would hurt. That would be infinite. But first derivative is just a finite jump to the discontinuity.
Well, apparently you can do integration by parts against the derivative. In this case, you can't. And just say that's not necessary.
I don't see how it'll hurt you in this case. Because you can just integrate the Hamiltonian. Okay, so to summarize the phenomenology of the chameleon, the fifth force due to this chameleon scalar with the self-interaction must be attractive. It picks up characteristic length scale, which depends on its self-interaction, and it's about a tenth of a millimeter. It falls off rapidly on scales larger than the Flynn scale. It falls off much more rapidly than gravity, that is. And it couples only to a shell of a certain thickness at the edge of the plane. Because you remember that as I go to a larger and larger plane, it just won't see the extra piece of the plane I added in. It'll only see the part of the plane that it takes for the field to rise to its maximum. Now, a few of those properties is difficult to see because, first of all, I have to be able to get masses. I have to be able to get two masses together down to scales of order a tenth of a millimeter. And secondly, the masses that I see, or the masses that I have to use themselves, have to be on the scale of about a tenth of a millimeter, because anything more than that would just not help me. Would not add any fifth force, but would just add more gravity. So the ideal experiment for looking at these is the Edwash experiment, which is in the right range of distance and mass gains. The way the Edwash experiment works is they have one disk up top, which is just a disk with holes punched into it. And this disk is mounted on a torsion pendulum. These two guys here are mirrors, and they can see minor deflections of the torsion pendulum by the deflection it makes on by the fact that it deflects a laser. Now they set this thing up, and on the bottom here they have another disk with a similar configuration of holes punched into it. This disk is called the attractor disk, and they rotate the attractor disk very slowly. So as the pendulum remains fixed, they rotate the attractor very slowly, and the pendulum will then be torqued in such a way to make the holes on the pendulum line up with the holes on the attractor. And so you can predict what kind of torques you'd expect by the attractor on the pendulum, just due to Newtonian gravity, and you can look for deviations from this. The distance between the attractor and the pendulum is the distance scale on which you're measuring gravity in this case. Now, this plot is taken from the same paper by Adelberger, Helfenkel, and Nelson. This is actually their old apparatus, which is a disk with 10 holes. What they're looking at now is something like the picture on the left, which just has no holes bored into it. This improvement has 42 holes instead of 10. This is an improvement because each hole on the attractor drags the pendulum. And so essentially, you're using more test masses. You should expect a bigger signal. And the next generation apparatus that they're working on, rather than having holes, has wedges. This is if you took a pie, cut it into slices, and removed every other slice. So the black ridges here are high, and the white regions are cross between ridges. And in this case, both the pendulum and the attractor would look like this. They rotate one. Question? So this is made of molybdenum, and these are just holes in molybdenum. On this side, they have a titanium base, and they have a thin rhenium foil on top of it that contains the wedges.
But if it's conducting, you get a strong cadmium.
Excuse me?
If it's conducting material, you get a cadmium.
So they put a foil between the pendulum and the attractor to screen out any electrical effects.
No, but even neutral conductors will have a force between the current and the force. And if you make it inhomogeneous, it can grab the other thing as well.
I believe they've corrected for this, actually.
Yeah.
I'm sure they're corrected for this. Okay, so the Edwash experiment is sensitive to torques down to about 10 to the minus 16 nanometers, 0.15 nanometers. And so the purpose of these different rings is just to give you a larger and larger signal that you can detect. Now, I'll talk about the solution that Justin and I have been working on, the solution to the field equations. I showed you an exact solution earlier, but that's just impossible for complicated mass configuration. So I'm doing this numerically. I do it by discretizing space. Take x, y, and z on the lattice. And the approximate Hamiltonian on the lattice then just becomes finite differences for the kinetic terms. And for my finite difference, I use a two-point numerical derivative. So the idea is that the Hamiltonian turns from a functional of the field into a function of a huge number of field variables. If I have nx, ny, and z, respectively, lattice points in the x, y, and z directions, the Hamiltonian becomes a function of nx, ny, and z variables. And so I can take the derivative of this Hamiltonian with respect to each of these variables, and by doing that, get the gradient of the Hamiltonian, and then I just put this into a standard conjugate gradient minimization solver. So similar to the numerical residues one.
You discretize the Hamiltonian, not the equations of motion.
That's right. And the solution I get looks something like this. I've done this for the next generation experiment with the two wedges. So right here is the titanium base of the attractor, the titanium base of the pendulum. Here's one wedge on the attractor and one wedge on the pendulum. And since rhenium is much denser than titanium is 4.5 grams per cubic centimeter, and rhenium is 21, the field gets really high inside the rhenium and goes low inside this titanium base. Meanwhile, between the two rings, there's a vacuum. And the force that I get at this point is zero.
Could you tell us again, so there's two disks, what's the composition thing to be really?
Excuse me? There's two disks?
So there are different compositions, what's the setup again?
the setup of the disks.
Yeah.
So each disk has a...
The horizontal of this picture.
Oh, okay, right. I'm looking at a disk kind of as flat in the plane coming out of the page here, and the wedge sticks up. So my disk is like this, and the wedge sticks up from it.
Okay.
And so I'm looking at just a sort of side view here, and you'd see a disk and wedge is sticking up, and then another disk on top, and wedge is pointing downwards, and this one would move past this one. And so the wedge here will attract the wedge. All right, so my solution just looks at this over a whole range of different angles. And you can see that the torque I would expect when the two edges are lined up is at zero by symmetry, rises to a certain peak value, plateaus at some value, and then falls off to nearly zero as the wedges move apart. So before I talk about my results, I'll discuss possible errors in the code. When I decrease the lattice space. So first off, this number here is, again, for the next generation experiment. I'm expecting the torque up to about 0.4 meters, and I'm looking at several possible errors. When I decrease the lattice spacing by factor of 2 in both directions, the change I get is of order 1%. It's almost no change. When I look at the force from the nearby wedge, for example, here's the pendulum, and the attractor is moving in this direction. I've computed the force due to this wedge on the pendulum, and I've neglected all other wedges. So if I add in the force due to the next wedge over, I get something a fraction of 1%. Now, I've actually approximated, rather than a wedge, I've used a rectangular ridge, or a rectangular block. And that makes the code easier because I have more symmetry. So I've tested that approximation by, rather than doing a wedge, I chopped up the wedge into three sections and treated them as three individual rectangular blocks. This one matching the length, matching the minimum thickness of the wedge, this matching the middle thickness, and this matching the rightmost thickness. And I've compared the results I get from this configuration to this one, where this is a better approximation to the wedge. And I get times 10 to the minus 4 vector meters. Again, small correction. The way I accounted for the torque due to this wedge and this wedge are just to add the torque I would expect from this to the torque I'd expect from this by itself. And you could argue that since this is a nonlinear field theory, I shouldn't just be able to add the torque from one object to the torque of another. But it turns out not to matter very much. When I repeat the computation and include both of these wedges at the same time, I get almost no change. And the final two checks are really checks of convergence of my code. That is, I start out my code with randomly distributed initial conditions. Random between the vacuum value of the field and whatever value of the field I'd expect inside the medium. And when the two wedges, the wedge on the attractor and the pendulum, are lined up, I should see no force at all. But due to my random initial conditions, I'll see some small spurious force, and that turns out to be very small. And also, when I change the random number key, one initial random number to another, again, the change of course is very small. So finally, the results. What Etwash will do will report is the Fourier transform torque, or rather the first three components of the Fourier transform torque that are not required to be zero by symmetry. The first one just looks like a sine, and when I add a small component of the second frequency, peak shifts a bit. When I add a small component of the third frequency, the peak squishes a bit. So essentially, they can see a sinusoidal signal, and they can see shifts in the peak, and they can see a flattening of the peak. Now, unfortunately, the current experiment, the one with the 42 holes in the pendulum and the tractor, won't be able to see a chameleon, at least with unit couplings. a plug of the torque that I'd expect as a function of angle for several different combinations of parameters. The red curve right here, which barely rises to 1 centimeter, is what I'd expect at the shortest distance that the current experiment can reach at lambda equals beta equals 1. And that is about a 1 sigma effect, roughly there. Now, it turns out that if I raise beta to about 3, I should be able to see something. Take the purple curve right here. But this next generation experiment, the 120 wedges, is a factor of 3 more sensitive. And so I'd expect at the exact same distance to get a curve about 3 times as large. It turns out that one of these wedges contributes about the same as one of the holes. And in this case, this is a number I showed you earlier. So I would expect that the next generation at Walsh experiment will be able to see a chameleon with lambda and beta equals 1. Now, it turns out that due to the geometry of this apparatus with the wedges are flat on top, I would expect some flattening of the peak, and so I have a third component, the torque also. But that's too small for them to see, the small separations. I've plotted also the fall off of this first Fourier component with distance. So this dz here is the separation between the two edges. So that's the scale on which I'm measuring gravity. And you can see that below roughly one character, something of order of the characteristic length, I essentially see nothing. I would get a 2 sigma effect about here, which is below z of 0.1 millimeters. So it's absolutely crucial that they get their uncertainties in this region right. And actually, there were some rumors a while ago that a few of you might have heard that they were actually seeing a repulsive force at very short ranges. And I've heard more recently that when they fixed up and recoded their apparatus, that went away and actually turned into an attractive force. So it's uncertain right now as to what they're exactly getting at small scales. And this is why they haven't published the current experiment.
So the rumors include a number of sigmas, or was it?
I've just heard it as a rumor. So Justin, Seth told you something about this, right?
Yeah. It's not a rumor. He said the results that the apparatus stated in Virginia doesn't see any effect present. Because they had a thing going down like that, and then they redid the whole thing. And then they got exactly the same effect going up.
Yeah.
The two cancel one another almost identically. So there's no violation of any
Right. So the point is they don't really understand what's going on. Right? Because they recoded their apparatus and they found sign that the effect changes. So.
What do you mean by recoded
the apparatus? Oh, so each of these disks is coated with a very thin layer of gold.
Coated,
yeah.
So where would you expect turnover of your curve how small is that? I mean, it can't go to infinity, right? There should be turnover at which value of that?
Oh, at which value you expect this?
Like, what is the maximum value you can get for arbitrary small distances?
That's a good question. I haven't really thought about that because this is really as low as they can go. I mean, this is rather optimistic. It won't go to infinity. I imagine it'll stop at some zero. Yeah, no, I haven't thought about that at all. Okay, and I've also plotted the other two Fourier components. The third Fourier component is not negligible. That is, the peak is kind of flattened on top, and the second Fourier component is essentially negligible. And again, these effects are only prominent in the region delta C is less than about 0.1. All right, finally, so to conclude, a chameleon field with the flight of the force self-interaction will give rise to an attractive force that falls off rapidly with distance and has a characteristic mass scale that only couples to objects only couples to the thin shell of an object, where the shell thickness is of order of this character's length scale. Now, the Etwash experiment is in the right region to test objects at this, to test gravity on these land scales. And the current experiment is just beginning to constrain the interesting region of parameter space, so that beta is a few times unity and lambda is 1/(a few times unity), they should be able to see something. But even more optimistic, the next generation Etwash experiment should be able to see a signal from lambda = beta = 1 coming in fields. Questions?
I recently published a paper with Mark Stevens. We had a, from the gravity theory, we could have gotten you to touch the color. And we made G and the effective flash run to the scale. And then we showed that the standard picture with the fifth force parent ceases to be significant beyond Saturn.
On what scales do you have to pay? Cosmological scale?
The reason is you're putting in an effective scale dependence on your color. So one has to be careful about that picture. Particularly since the observational data for the outer planets we discovered is not good.
I see.
Because it's all optical. There's no radar ranging beyond Mars, Jupiter, and Cassini. So you have a specific assumption about the fifth force.
I see. So you're saying that the planetary constraint should really be cut off at order 10 AU and not 10,000. Fair enough. So I've actually heard the cosmological theories of gravity, DGP for example, where G also varies on very large scales.
Oh, yeah. Scales, but it's galaxies, there's no, it's all anyway. There's no statement at all.
Right. Any more questions?
No, I have one question. So, can you comment on, so suppose you were to detect this fifth force, can you comment on the ability to distinguish between this and a normal massive scalar?
I mean, normal masses with a scalar field with alpha is, which is a very small alpha. The problem is that they can just barely see things in this very low mass range, so I can give you a characteristic shape of this torque versus angle curve, but they just won't be able to see any flak that I expect from this. So unless they can really detect this fall off of the field over this range of about 1/20 of a millimeter and compare this fall off to what they'd expect from the UCAWA, I don't expect any definite signatures of this. I just hope that they'll see something. And maybe a next generation experiment will be able to detect the shape of the field.
Another question, what happens with the gravitational field of the sun?
Gravitational field of the sun?
For this Hermitian force.
So since objects outside are just sensitive to a thin shell, all they see is the 1 millimeter thick or 1/10 millimeter thick shell on the outside of the sun, so it does nothing.
They don't see anything.
Right. So because of this, the planetary constraints, which are actually rather tight, at least for, say, Earth, go down by orders of magnitude. The planetary upper bound on alpha becomes something like 10^72, just because you're only seeing a tiny, tiny fraction of the sun. And this was my comment earlier, where you can't take planes that are much larger than the land scale and test with that, because gravity completely swamps the effect you'd see. So you really have to test this on scales that are afforded of the land scale.
Just a question. So one is have you tried that self-interacting potential besides quite before? And the other one, can you again explain a bit, because you have assumed that you have superimposed modes in the, you have seen some kind of linearity where the theory is non-linear. Can you explain a little bit this again?
Okay, so the first question, no, I haven't looked at other modes. I just wanted to put in a renormalizable correction and just show in principle that the sort of correction would make a huge difference for constraints on fifth forces, particularly at planetary scales. And you that you have to test it is a correct experience. Your second question?
It's about in the experiment, you showed one of the slides, you said it's a non-linear theory.
Yes.
and but then you assume some kind of linearity, you just impose the effect.
Oh, in other words, so when I was doing the calculation, I just treated one wedge moving past another wedge and computed the torque as a function of angle. And then there's another wedge coming in here as this one gets 2 pi over 120 over this other wedge comes and moves in. So I treated the force due to this as just added on, yeah, independent. Now, that was one of the errors that I checked for. Table, right. That's one of the errors I checked for, so that I redid the code where I included both wedges on the track at the same time. And it turns out that they're so far apart, they're of order a millimeter or two apart, that the field due to one just doesn't affect the field due to the other. And so it's a timing correction, less than 1%.
For this particular design,
Exactly. So if the wedges were closer, right, the field wouldn't have a chance to drop to the back to something close to the vacuum value between the wedges. Question?
I mean, so there was an effective theory where you started basically from a non-relativistic description. I mean, couldn't it be that the real relativistic theory generates a noise term effectively in this non-relativistic equation of motion?
Noise term? A correction potential, for example?
Yeah.
I'm not sure what kind of noise term I'd expect. Yeah, no, at very small scales, I would just expect all these non-renormalizable interactions to go away, and I'd just be left with the final form.
You talked about how the potential flows in RG.
Yeah. From an RG point of view, we should have decoupled. Right. I mean, that's probably okay. But I was just wondering what you effectively do if you would have a fundamental field theory here, and you would let's say you decompose it in terms of modes. What you effectively do is you put a filter in which traps only those modes you're interested in. So that's basically the long wavelength modes. But then if you write down the equation of motions for only the long wavelength modes, you get even for the dynamics of the long wavelength modes, term which is dominated by short waves. And this generates effectively something like noise in the system. I was just interested if you have estimated this.
Yeah, system. No, I haven't estimated that.
The people who worry about the cosmological quantum problem, which includes me, compared with anybody else, there's a few suggestions that you cut off a 0-point vacuum energy at 10⁻³ electron volts to the fourth power, which is just getting in there at the burden around something less than a millimeter. So, according to his major results, he sees nothing in violation of the use. You want to see something happening, okay?
I would think so. Yeah, so in this case, the vacuum value of the field is just zero. The vacuum value of the energy density is zero. Now, there's an earlier version of the chameleon. This idea actually came up from a paper Justin wrote about years ago, where rather than taking a potential of this form, he takes a potential that looks like 1 over 5 to the sum power. And this field has cosmological effects. This field has some non-zero small potential energy. And again, there's this characteristic scale of about 1 over millimeter to the fourth being your lambda density. So this, the field that I put in here won't do anything cosmological. But the original chameleon, yeah, that's what it was intended for. Yeah, I probably made a good description. Okay. There we go.
Okay, other questions? Otherwise, let's thank them all for a very nice.